Accession number 7310, rule number 6.
Colonel Cleve, tape 6.
After lunch with Mrs. Minogue, now of course her house has been built over, my mother went home, and of course I went back to the convalescent home, and everything went on normally, and one day the matron came to me and said, "Do you know what?" I said, "No." So she said, "Mrs. Annie Minogue is changing her house." "Oh," I said, "what, that beautiful house in Berkeley Square?" "Yes." And she said, "Do you know where she's going?" I said, "No." "She's bought Cleve House in Hyde Park Corner, which I think is still there. And, "Oh," I said, "really, why?" "Oh, I don't know," she said, "but anyway, Cleve Lodge, I think it's called." And I said, "That's very interesting, how amusing." And then a few days later, "Would I like to go and have lunch with her at Cleve House?" So I said, "Oh, yes, of course I would." So it was all arranged that I should have lunch with her at Cleve House, Cleve Lodge. And I had lunch. And after lunch, she showed me all around the house, beautifully equipped. She complained that it hadn't been repainted because of the war, but she was going to do that as soon as she could. And then she took me into the garden. There was a hard tennis court at the back. Can you imagine it now? I don't know whether the tennis court is still there, but I believe the lodge is. The tennis court at the back, and then into an arbour at the end of it. And then we stood in the arbour and looked at the house. And she said, "To think," she pointed to the house, "that all this can be yours." "Oh," I said, "oh, don't bother about that. No, that wouldn't, thank you," something like that. It never occurred to me what she meant. And I was so innocent. Anyway, I thanked her very much for a very nice lunch and for meeting her, and hoped we'd meet again kind of thing. And then before long I was posted away, and that was that. And then, months afterwards, in December, I think it was, 1917, by which time I completely recovered and was up in Newcastle, I read the paper one day, and there was an announcement of a wedding to Mrs. Annie Minogue to Lieutenant so-and-so, who was my rival at Lady Dudley's. And it's been a family joke ever since that I missed a most wonderful opportunity, because she was already 60, if not older, and to think we might have been thoroughly rich by having inherited all that money. However, it's an enormous family joke, and we've had great fun over it ever since.
And you really didn't spot the opportunity.
I wouldn't have accepted it had she given it to me again.
Did you find that when you were home and wounded, that civilians made a great fuss of you? Were you treated very well in England?
Oh, yes, extremely well. People were most kind, and I think awfully sympathetic, not only to myself, but to my parents. And they couldn't have been nicer. Because a lot of our friends here in Wimbledon and others, relations too, had taken an enormous interest in my war letters, which I wrote home constantly. And my parents always knew where I was, because I had a secret code with them, because I wrote on very thin paper, and whenever I had a new move, I put a little pinprick through a letter. Say it was Collincamp, C, then another one, O, L, I, N, like that. And then by holding up to the light, they could see the name was Collincamp, or whatever it was. And in that way, they knew all my movements. But my father, being a military man, then stationed at the War Office, and of course my mother being very, very good, They were very secretive about it. But they kept all those letters, all my letters from the front, and they're now somewhere hidden away in the Imperial War Museum.
Which is very appropriate, I think, as we're sitting here recording for the Imperial War Museum.
Well, I think I have a great interest in it anyway. Yes.
It's more than I normally... Did you find, when you came home in 1917, that civilians really understood what was going on in France? Did they know the nature of that war, do you think?
I think many did, because they had so many sons and relations out there who must have conveyed all their feelings home. And my feeling was that there was a general feeling, attitude of support, and many people were in deep sympathy for what was being done, because I think they all felt that the principle for which we were fighting was so essential to be preserved. It was so essential that they should be preserved. That was the atmosphere, I'm sure, of the whole country at that time.
Would you say there was still enthusiasm for the war?
Terrific, because there were sort of working parties all over the place, making bandages and sewing shirts and doing all sorts of things. Oh yes, wherever you met, wherever you went, you found people doing something for the war effort, as it was called then. And all the young girls were either VADs, nurses, or drivers, and the ladies were drivers of... VADs anyway, they're all doing something.
Did you regain your sight fairly quickly?
It took me a long time to get the sight back in the left eye. And the doctors, I think, were obviously very worried, because they didn't quite know when the day would come, if it did, when it might shift a tiny little bit, when I would have been blinded. And it was for that reason they were terribly anxious and wouldn't operate. And it took months for me to pass the medical test for going out again. And I suppose it must have lowered my whole state of health, which I didn't realise at the time, because it wasn't, I think, till about October that year that I was past fit for active service again.
Did you enjoy your spell in England, though? Was it a relief to be free from the fleas and the rats?
It was very nice. I must say I did enjoy it, every moment of it. And it was so nice to be at home. We were a very united family, a very close family, and we loved all our music and art and all things like that. So it was a grand chance to have a bit of music with my mother again and that kind of thing. It was very enjoyable. I did enjoy, I made the most of it, I must say.
Did you find that you enjoyed the creature comforts too?
Yes, I've always enjoyed my creature comforts very much. And beautiful things. I love being surrounded by beautiful things, because they give me beautiful thoughts. I'm sure.
And did you miss this at the front, the fact that you didn't have anything beautiful around you? Did you find that you missed this very much?
When I was in the front? Oh, very much. And I was so delighted when, for instance, I went to one of our billets and found there was a Pleyel piano there. The Pleyel is a very famous French name, and that I enjoyed very much indeed. That's a great joy. But I did miss it so much. Fortunately, my major, Dean, who was quite well off, brought over a very good gramophone, portable gramophone, and had a lot of classical records. And I learnt some of my best, some of the classical music I know and like best from those days when, after all the heat and sweat of battle, The major put on a beautiful classical record of Kirkby Lunn or somebody like that, singing most beautifully. It was really delightful. I loved it then. But on the whole, I feel those were just a few sort of bright spots, and the rest of it not so bright. But on the other hand, one felt one had a tremendously important duty to perform, and so we all got on with it and got on extremely well.
Were you anxious to get back to the front when you began to recover?
Oh, very anxious indeed. I did my best to get fit, and I fought tooth and nail to pass my medical tests, and I was so delighted when I did, and even more delighted when I was given a very important appointment which I knew would take me back to France.
Could you describe that appointment now and these circumstances which took you back?
Well, when I began to get better, I was sent on a battery commander's course at Lark Hill, and we had to shoot all kinds of things there, targets. And my turn came, and I was given a very important what we call proximity shoot to do on a target, which was very close to the front line, only about 50 yards away. We were supposed to be in the observation post, which was a bomb-proof shelter in a little bit of a trench, and I was pointed out a pseudo-enemy trench only 50 yards away. I was told to get on with destroying that, but not our own OP. So I remember my enormous delight when, after all my calculations and ordered the first gun to fire, which is a 9-2, the shell fell only 50 yards behind it. Then, with a correction, the next one fell about 25 yards beyond it, and so far as my memory serves me, the third round fell right on it. And so there was no need to fire for me to waste any more ammunition. So they wrote me off, and the next thing I knew was that I had been sent for by AG6 of the War Office, which gave us all our appointments, and Major Dapperjit told me that I had been very strongly recommended from the battery commander's course. I was then still a captain, an acting captain. Would I like to take on a very special assignment? Oh, I said, yes, I would. It'll take me back to France. And then he told me that GHQ France were terribly anxious about the Hindenburg line because they felt it was so strong it was holding up our movements, and no shelling that they had in France at that time was anywhere near powerful enough to really to damage the Hindenburg line. What could the War Office possibly do to produce something heavier? And it was at that fortunate moment that the Admiralty got onto the War Office and offered them 16 14-inch Mark III barrels, which had come out of the turrets of a Chilean battleship Cochrane up at Vickers Armstrong's, which at that time was being converted into HMS Eagle, the first aircraft carrier. And not wanting the guns, they offered them to the War Office. Oh, they said, that's splendid. So they accepted the offer with gratitude. At the same moment, they ordered 12, not 16, but the four gun barrels were to be spare, 12 railway mountings to be built that would take these 14-inch naval guns. And it was a real problem because naturally they were required to shoot at maximum range, and the problem was what to do with the recoil, because as you know, when guns fire they recoil anything from 5 to 6 or 7 feet and sometimes more according to the size of the gun. The oil buffer and glands check the recoil, and then they finish their duty at the end of the recoil, and the recovery, the recuperation, is made by the recuperators, which are usually hydropneumatic, and the pressures there which have been accumulated during the recoil push the barrel back again to its normal position. And at extreme elevation, it would have been extremely difficult to find enough room for for a gun with the trunnions in the, at the centre of gravity to find enough room for the recoil without fouling the rails. So how they got over that problem, it was all right for firing fairly horizontally up to, say, 15 degrees, but not beyond. So they got over the problem very skillfully by making a balancing system. The balancing system was extra to the recoil and recuperating system. The balancing system consisted of two very large hydropneumatic cylinders which helped the elevation of the gun and enabled the trunnions to be put only about, very far back towards the breech. And the balancing system compensated for what we in gunnery circles call muzzle preponderance. That was that the muzzle portion of the gun was so much heavier than the breech portion that nothing could elevate the gun unless it was completely balanced, so that the weight between the trunnions and the muzzle and the trunnions and the breech was precisely the same. And that was overcome by the balancing system being connected to the breech in such a way that it pulled it down to the pressure that was needed to elevate the muzzle, extra bit of muzzle. And that pressure had to be precisely 1,200 pounds per square inch in the balancing system, otherwise it was impossible to elevate the gun. And we had, in France, a most terrible trouble, because if it got 8 pounds below or above, you couldn't elevate, except by hand. And it took 20 minutes between rounds to elevate the gun by hand, and it was frightfully heavy work in any case. So we were thankful when the balancing system worked well, which normally it did. Anyway, that was that. And that was how the guns was able to recoil at maximum elevation, which was 43 degrees, and not foul the railway line and at the recoil, extreme point of recoil. And that really, in practical terms, meant that the gun, enormous though it was extremely mobile from the railway point of view. And I had a most awful job in World War I, as well as in World War II, to try and get across to the nitwits of commanders who couldn't appreciate mobility, railway mobility, how I could get across to them that the gun was really mobile. So much so that on one occasion, it said in the handbook that the speed of the gun wasn't to be more than 15 miles an hour, otherwise the axles would overheat. And that's in the handbook. And then the railway authorities were very annoyed, because in this country the minimum speed was for goods trains was 25, and they had to make special schedules to make this wretched thing go at 15 miles an hour. But during World War II, they broke all rules and regulations, because the gun then was stationed in Kent for anti-invasion purposes. And one day it was decided to take the gun to Lark Hill to do some shooting practice there. And before they could say Jack Robinson, the way the train went at 45 miles an hour, by that time we'd had Westinghouse brakes fitted on. And everybody was terrified out of their wits. Oh, the axle box is what's going to happen. Nothing happened. And so it was decided after that that the faster the gun went, the better, because the speed of revolution got the oil circulating so quickly that there was never time for the axles to get hot. so that completely revolutionised the mobility of the guns. Anyway, they were mobile from the railway point of view, and of course one has to remember that in 1918 the railway systems in all countries were far more numerous than they are now, and especially so in the north of France, which is rather a manufacturing area. And there were lots of factories with sidelines and things that had been demolished but easily repaired, and main lines. And so it was comparatively simple to have railway guns there, because all the sappers really had to do was to build a spur, which is a curved line going off the main line. Then the gun could fire in any position on that curve according to the azimuth at which it was required to shoot. So that's why railway guns really became quite the thing. And it was extremely clever of them to make this biggest gun of all the most mobile of all the railway guns that we had, because all the other ones took 3 hours minimum to get into their positions, and when they're into their positions they had to be anchored down and all sorts of things, which was awfully troublesome. But Bosch Buster, we found in World War One, was so mobile that we could up sticks and away within 5 minutes of being shelled. That was saved our heads many times in World War One. It was a marvellous gun, a marvellous mounted gun, design gun, so much so that a book now is being written in German, published in Germany, and the co-editor is an Austrian friend of mine, and some of the book will be written about Bosch Buster and its design, and the other part of the book is the German story, which will talk about the Paris gun and the super heavy long range guns which they had with a range of 75 miles. So it's very interesting. It's sort of coming into its own again now, or the interest attached to it.
Was it difficult getting this over to France? Can you remember the... Did you go over with the gun?
Well, it was rather interesting, because normally it would have been extremely difficult, but the Vickers Armstrong was so good at the design that they had designed it with slings, which we carried in the magazine wagon. And the slings could sling any part of the gun, not weighing more than 15, except the barrel itself, not weighing more than, should we say, 15 or some, up to 50 tons, in pieces if it had to be slung and taken in pieces over to France and then reassembled in France. And that came into World War II at one time, in a way, yes. Anyway, it could be taken to pieces, but how we got it over to France, I didn't know it was going to happen, but there was a railway ferry at that time which operated between Richmond and Calais, and it was a marvellous contraption, very simple, and it had two parallel railway lines on the top deck. And at that time, Richborough Harbour must have been dredged out to take its weight. And railway trains were frequently taken over to France, two or three carriages at a time, or trucks, whatever they were, with heavy things on them, loads on them sometimes, and on these two parallel lines. And when they got to France, they were joined up again to two lines there. But Bosch Buster was rather an exception, and there's a picture, a priceless picture, which I saved, which is now in the Royal Military Institution in Woolwich, which shows the two guns, Bosch Buster and Scene Shifter, alongside each other on the Richborough ferry, before leaving Richborough. And then when we got them to France, we were already there, and we had to receive them. Shall I tell you the story of how they were landed? It was a terrible moment. Pouring with rain, well, that didn't matter. But the thing was, nobody realised how heavy these guns were. Each mounting, complete with barrel, weighed 243 tons, which was rather a lot in a length, which was a total length, which was only about 90 feet, I think I'm right in saying. Anyway, there was the locomotive on shore, a little Nordsee Knot, all ready to draw or to connect up and draw off the first gun. It connected up, the ferry of course was connected by that time, and the railway lines were joined, and the locomotive was joined up to the to Boschbuster, and it began to move. And what nobody realized was that as the weight was removed from the stern of the ferry, that the whole ferry would lift up. It did. And Buster said to itself, "Be damned with that wretched locomotive, get it out of the way," took charge and pushed the locomotive out of the way. We were terrified. We thought, oh dear, the whole thing's going to fall to pieces or fall into the water, which we were still. The ferry took a tremendous lurch towards the side of the scene shifter, and that might have toppled over, but I think the operators were so skilled at adjusting the reserve tanks that they immediately filled the tank, which had been comparatively empty probably on the side of Boschbuster, and balanced it up again, and then we knew what to expect with the scene shifter. And we weren't allowed onto the ferry beforehand, otherwise we would have put the handbrakes on. We thought they were on, but they couldn't have been, I don't think. Or they may have been, I don't know. Anyway, it took charge. But we managed to get scene shifter off very much better because we learnt our lesson then. So that was a very narrow, so the narrow squeak, I think, that Boschbuster had of becoming derailed. Scene shifter had an accident by becoming derailed, or a Red Cross train got derailed and ran into it, or something, I don't know what it was, an awful mix-up, but not us. So that's how we got off, got the train off, the guns off.
The idea was they had to be on rails the whole time, these guns.
The whole time. They were only designed to fire from the railway line. They couldn't possibly have gone by road. No road would have taken them. And, oh yes, they were beautifully designed. They were wonderfully designed guns. And in these days, they would have had... the only troubles we really had with them were two... which